Our speaker this hour is another one of our treasured faculty members. Aaron Birch is the son of Eugene and Rita Birch of Salem, Ohio. He is married to the former Catherine Langeman. Did I pronounce that correctly? Good. They have four daughters, Esther, Hannah, Lydia, and Tabitha. Aaron is the graduate of the West Virginia, is a graduate of the West Virginia School of Preaching in 2007 and received his bachelor's in biblical studies from Freed Hardeman University in 2009. He's presently working on a master's degree from Freed Hardeman University, living in Lisbon, Ohio area. And during the first quarter, he teaches the life of Christ for us at the West Virginia School of Preaching. We are tickled that Aaron is here today. We love him for his work's sake and all that he does. Aaron.
I appreciate very much the opportunity to speak today. Thank you to the elders and the lectureship committee for the opportunity. Thank you as well to Brother Goddard and Brother Andy for their kind words. I was also thinking how hospitable the ladies are here at the congregation. I appreciate the lunch and your kind hospitality that you've shown to us. I love the school, and I love what it does, and I appreciate so very much the congregation here and all that are involved with the school. It's hard for me to think that it has been 10 years since I started school here. It doesn't seem, on one hand, like it's been that long ago, but on the other hand, it seems like a long time ago. When I came to school, I suppose you might say I was a little bit on the green side. I wasn't necessarily young. I had been out of school for about 8 years, but I'd pretty much just milked cows. That's about all I'd done. And when I came to school, I really didn't know anybody. I knew Brother Pugh. I'd met Brother Darty. He held a meeting for us once when I was younger. I'd met Brother Cooper a couple times. I'd met the elders. I knew one of the students. That was about it. And that changed pretty fast. I started school, and the first day of school, we had about 6 inches of snow, if I remember right. We had so much snow that a couple of the students who traveled from a distance were unable to come to class that day. We had class like normal, and then the next day, they were able to clear the roads enough that the two students I hadn't met were able to come. And I shook their hands during chapel. We went up to the school. I sat in the place where I had sat the day before, and I'm sitting there getting my things ready for class, and one student says to me, "You're in my seat." And I said, "Okay," and thought about it for a moment. And then I noticed he's still standing there. He was expecting me to move. That was the first time I met Edward Partain. The other student, when I shook his hand in chapel, about crushed my hand. That was the first time I met Craig Matheny, otherwise known as Bubba, at least during that period of time at school. Well, we went through the first week, and the end of the second week, I started in the middle of the year. I started in January. And we were supposed to go to the Freed Hardeman Lectures. Brother Cooper had told me beforehand, and I had saved some money so that I could go. And when I came to school, he asked me if I knew how I was going to get there, if I had made arrangements. Well, apparently all the other students were planning on carpooling. And I didn't know any of the other students, so I hadn't made arrangements yet. Well, I think Brother Cooper talked to some of the students, and I talked as well. And finally, Craig told me, he said, "Well, you can ride with us. It's just me and Eddie. And the back seat will be wide open. And so you can have the whole back seat." So I said, okay. I followed Eddie home Friday night after school. And I'd only been in school for 2 weeks at this point in time. Followed him home from school. And we left early the next morning. Craig met us at Eddie's house. Somewhere, I don't know, around Kentucky, somewhere, I think. We're driving down the road, and Craig says to Eddie, "Eddie, can we stop at the exit? I need to go to the bathroom." I didn't think anything strange of that until we drove past the exit. We went down the road a little more, and there was another exit coming up, and Craig said again, "Eddie, I need to go to the bathroom." And we drove past the exit again, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, I can hear this, and I'm in the back seat. What's going on? And if you know Craig, you could see the red rising up the back of his neck. We get a little further down the road, and it's been about a half an hour now. This is the third exit. And Craig says, "Eddie, I need to go to the bathroom." This time we get to the exit, Eddie giggles, and we keep going. And now I know what's going on, and so does Bubba, and his face is completely red. And it's about that time that he sticks out that big bear paw of a hand of his, and he grabs Eddie by the side of the head and starts beating it off the window saying, "I gotta go to the bathroom." And Eddie's laughing and giggling and half screaming, and I'm sitting in the back seat. These guys are nuts. They're absolutely crazy. I'm going to die. I'm actually going to die. Well, we pulled over on the side of the highway after swerving across both lanes. We pull over, and Craig had to go bad enough. He ran over in the weeds, and Eddie's sitting in the car laughing hysterically. Boy, I think he was mad. And I'm like, no kidding. That was my second week of school and how I came to know Craig and Eddie. A couple days later, we made it to the lectureship. And a couple days later, we were supposed to meet to do something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but Eddie didn't show up. And Craig did, and I said, "Where's Eddie?" Because they were staying in a room together. And Craig said, I don't know about him some days. I prayed for patience, and God gave me Eddie. Well, I don't know if that's the reason that God brought Eddie into Bubba's life or not, but the Bible clearly agrees with Craig's backwoods theology that God does give us patience. The psalmist in Psalm 62, our text for this hour, wrote, "Truly, my soul silently waits for God. From him comes my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. How long will you attack a man? You shall be slain, all of you, like a leaning wall and a tottering fence. They only consult to cast him down from his high position. They delight in lies. They bless with their mouth, but they curse inwardly. Selah. My soul waits silently for God alone, for my expectation is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be moved. In God is my salvation and my glory. The rock of my strength and my refuge is in my God. Trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Selah. Surely men of low degree are a vapor. Men of high degree are a lie. If they are weighed on the scales, they are altogether lighter than vapor. Do not trust in oppression nor vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart on them. God has spoken once, twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God. Also to you, O Lord, belongs mercy, for you render to each one according to his works." According to the superscription of this psalm was written to the chief musician, to Yeduthun, a psalm of David. Perhaps that information is correct. We need to accept it with reserve. As far as we know, the subscriptions or superscriptions to the Psalms are not inspired. But from looking at the Psalm itself, we can learn that the writer was in a terrible situation. He faced enemies within and without. We find that he had a high position, verse 4. And that others were blessing him on one hand, and on the other hand, they were cursing him. And so we can see in the psalm this kind of duplicity. People say one thing, they honor you with their lips, but their hearts are far from you. They're blessing and they're cursing. These individuals, they attacked the author and they sought to cast him down. That might fit, I suppose, any number of different circumstances in life, but perhaps it would fit that of a royal court. You can imagine that there are always those in a royal court who want to see you fall, that want to see you overthrown and brought down. King David certainly faced that during his reign. He faced it from Sheba in 2 Samuel chapter 20 in verse 1 through 22. But perhaps maybe even more importantly from his own son Absalom, as we read in 2 Samuel 15 through chapter 19. Perhaps, as the superscription suggests then, that David writes this song, and perhaps he writes this psalm at that point in time, during one of these rebellious events during his reign. He knows, perhaps, that there are enemies within his own court, within his own people, people who speak one thing to him and do another. As we look at the psalm, we see as well its emphasis. The psalmist places an emphasis upon trust in God, confidence in Him, and confidence in His deliverance by God. In verse 1, he says, "Truly my soul silently waits for God. From Him comes my salvation." The psalmist knows where his salvation comes from. He knows who has the power to deliver him. He knows whom he should trust. He emphasizes that in a number of different ways. In the Hebrew text, 10 of the verses of these 12 begin with the same sound. And in fact, 6 of the verses begin with the exact same word. In the New King James, that's translated as truly, surely, and alone. What he's emphasizing, it appears, is that there is only one in which he can trust. There is only one that can deliver him. In fact, there's also a type of refrain in verse 3 and verse 6. He says, "How long will you attack a man? You shall be slain, all of you, like a tottering fence." In fact, I want verse 2. "He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved." And so he repeats this idea of one and only. And then he emphasizes that it's God. God alone is his salvation. God alone can deliver him. He further emphasizes a number of different key ideas. This idea of silently he refers to in verse 1. And then he returns to it again in verse 5. "My soul waits silently for God." God is his rock, he repeats in verse 2 and verse 6 and verse 7. God is his salvation, verse 1, verse 2, verse 6 and verse 7. God is his defense, and therefore he shall not be moved. He is his refuge, his trust, and everything else is like a vapor. You see, the psalmist displays his trust in God. And in fact, he displays his trust in God alone as the one who is able to deliver him. He does that in another way as well, by making some contrasts. In the first few verses, he notes how he trusts in God. He relies upon God completely. His soul waits patiently from God. He only is my rock. But in contrast to that are the wicked people. The people who do not serve God, the people who turn against God. In verse 3, he says, "How long will you attack a man? You shall be slain, all of you, like a leaning wall and a tottering fence. They only consult to cast him down from his high position. They delight in lies. They bless with their mouth, but they curse inwardly." And so we see the psalmist, his character is one that trusts in God. But the wicked lie. They curse. They deceive. They also contrast with God himself. In verse 1 and verse 2, God is his salvation, his rock, his defense. In verse 5, God will bring his expectation. He again is his rock, his salvation, his defense. Verse 7, salvation, his glory, his rock, his refuge. Verse 8, trust in him. He is a refuge for us. But in contrast to God, everything else is vanity. Everything else is useless. Nothing can deliver but God. In verse 9, he says, surely men of low degree are a vapor. Men of high degree are a lie. If they are weighed on the scales, they are altogether lighter than vapor. Do not trust in oppression. Do not trust vainly or hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart on them. So God is the one that can deliver. God is the one that can save me. God is my defense and refuge. Everything else is worthless. In surveying the psalm, we see that the psalmist writes this psalm and declares his trust in God because he has found himself in a terrible situation. He has found himself in a situation where others want to see him fall. In verse 1 and verse 2, he emphasizes that he waits for God. And he waits for God's salvation. He says, truly my soul silently waits from God. From him comes my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. Important term, or one of the important terms here, is the term silently. He waits silently, and it's a roundabout way of referring to his patience. It indicates his reserve and patience even in the face of trial. It is, according to Kloer, a quietness of soul, a repose of spirit that comes from relinquishing all fears to God with the firm assurance that God can be trusted to care for those who trust in him. And so the psalmist is able to quietly and calmly, in the face of this terrible situation, he's able to remain there because he trusts in God. God will be his salvation. And in fact, God is his salvation. Yet, despite that, despite the fact that he can wait on God and God's salvation, he presently endures this terrible situation. In verse 3 and verse 4, as we've read, we note that there are those who are against him. They attack him. They attack him only to cast him down. They delight in lying. They bless with their mouths, but they curse inwardly. Perhaps if the setting is that of a royal court, we can see the idea, the subtle scheme to overthrow and to cast down the king. Nevertheless, even though he knows that these things are going on, the psalmist can patiently trust in God because God will protect him and he will not fall. Rather, in verse 3, his enemies will be destroyed and slain. And so beginning in verse 5, he talks about his hopeful salvation. Because he trusts in God, because he knows God is his salvation and his deliverance, he can hope. He can have hope and expectation that he will be saved. In verse 5, he says, my soul waits silently for God alone, for my expectation is from him. The term expectation here is that which is one's hope, what he expects to happen. You see, the psalmist not only believes that God is his deliverance, he believes that God will deliver him. And so he has hope in God. And he somewhat commands himself. Notice the terminology here. In verse 1, he made an assertion. Truly my soul waits for God. But in verse 5, he changes it a little bit and he makes it a command. He says, my soul wait silently for God alone. If you ever been in a distressing situation where you tried to encourage yourself? It's almost like the psalmist is doing that here. Be silent. Wait, my soul. Wait for God. Don't give up. Don't give in. The reason he can wait like that is because of who God is to him. Beginning in verse 6, he begins to pile up descriptions of God. He is his rock, his salvation, his defense, his glory, his refuge. We think of a rock, we think of something that's strong, hard to break down, hard to remove. And perhaps here, the psalmist not only has in mind a small rock, but a large rock, like a mountain, that is almost immovable. God is his rock. God is his place of protection and safety. God is as well his salvation, his deliverance. God is also his defense, and defense portrays a fortification. He is the one that fortifies God, or fortifies the psalmist, and keeps him from falling. But not only is God those things to him, he is also his glory. It suggests that the psalmist finds his praise in God, his reason for rejoicing in God alone. And so he must wait patiently for God to act. However, you know, as well as I do, that God doesn't always act in our time. God acts in his time. And so as the psalmist awaits God's deliverance, he waits patiently. He waits for God to act. He waits for God to deliver. Verse 9 then begins what we might call the psalmist's trustful supposition. He has hope that God will deliver. He believes that God will deliver, even though he's facing this terrible situation. But as well, he believes God will. And he makes a trustful supposition. In verse 9, he says, "Surely men of low degree are a vapor. Men of high degree are a lie. If they are weighed on the scales, they are altogether lighter than vapor. Do not trust in oppression, nor vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart on them." The psalmist does something here. He talks about God in verse 8. And then he talks about things that humans might think can deliver them. When we think about the things that can help us to get through terrible situations, or at least when people in general think of things that can help them get through terrible situations, what do we think of? I know one of the top things is wealth. If I had more money, I would be able to get through this more easily. Or at least, if I had friends that had more money, I could get through this. I could overcome this situation. The psalmist says no. Men of high degree, men of low degree, perhaps he's contrasting righteous men with wicked, or perhaps he's contrasting rich men with poor men. But either way, it doesn't matter. Both of them are like a vapor. The term here for vapor is the same term that's used in the book of Ecclesiastes for vanity. It's empty. It's worthless. Either situation, men who are rich or men who are poor, men who are righteous or men who are wicked, it doesn't matter. They're all vanity. They cannot deliver you. Some people might go beyond that, and they might resort to evil means to secure their lives and to secure their deliverance. But the psalmist says the same thing with that as well. Verse 10, "Do not trust in oppression, nor vainly hope in robbery." Do not trust in evil means of getting finances. Do not trust in evil ways of getting security. If riches increase, verse 10, do not set your heart on them. All is vanity. Don't vainly hope They're empty. Wicked men, rich men, poor men, righteous men, riches, wealth, evil. It's all vanity. It's all useless. But who then do you trust in? Trust in God. Verse 8. Trust in Him at all times, you people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us. If we want deliverance, where do we go? You don't go to men. You don't go to robbery. You don't go to wicked means. You go to God and God alone. In verse 11, he continues to describe God, and he says, God has spoken once, twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God. Who really has power in the world? Who really has the ability to deliver? Is it wealth? Is it physical strength? Is it money or power, human power? It's not. It's God. God alone has power. He is the one that has might and strength. In certain circumstances, these words are used for military fortifications and military power. You see, God has the ability. God has the strength to deliver. But God has more than that. Verse 12, also to you, O Lord, belongs mercy. For you render to each one according to his work. The term translated mercy here is the Hebrew word chesed. And perhaps in the Old Testament, there's no more important word. If it's not the most important, it is certainly one of the most important. It's translated in a number of different ways, even in a single translation, because of the various meaning, the plethora of meanings that the word has. Sometimes it refers to loving kindness. Sometimes to mercy, as it does here. Sometimes it's used to refer to God's love. Perhaps the best way to understand the word is with something like the phrase, God's covenant love. Because the term describes the love and the loyalty that God has for His covenant people. God cares for them. God loves them. And as long as they are faithful to Him, He will continue to do what is best for them. His love in that respect is always faithful. It is always loyal. It is always merciful. It is always true. But ask yourself, if God has that type of love for the psalmist in this situation, what will he do? If God has the power and the ability to deliver the psalmist from this awful situation that he faces, and he has the love, the covenant love for the psalmist to deliver him, what will he do? You see, what the psalmist is asserting here is that God will deliver him. Why? Because he knows that God loves him. And he knows that God has the ability and the power. And so now all the psalmist has to do is he has to wait. He just has to wait for God's time. Now again, God's time is not always our time. But he knows that when God does act, that God will act for his benefit. And notice the last phrase in verse 12. For you render to each one according to his work. What is God going to do to the psalmist's enemies? He's going to punish them and deliver the psalmist. And so throughout this psalm, what the psalmist is trying to help us understand is that he believes that God will deliver him. So what he needs to do is have patience, to wait on God. In this psalm, as we've already noticed, the author uses the term silently, and he uses it to refer to his patient confidence in God, the fact that he is able to wait for God to act. The term silence, or silently, though, in this context is rather interesting. It means rest. relief from trouble with an implication of being in a right relationship with God. Think about that for a moment. That's not what the psalmist enjoys here. He does not enjoy rest. He does not enjoy relief from trouble. So what's he mean? How do we understand this idea of silence? It's the type of silence that I think the psalmist in Psalm 37 and verse 7 describes. He says, "Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him." You see, it is patient rest. It is patient silence. A confidence and a relief that comes from knowing where one stands from God, with God. Of knowing one's relationship with God and calmly waiting on Him to act. See, this patience, this silence doesn't mean that I don't have trouble right now. It doesn't mean that I don't face a terrible situation. But it means because of who God is, I am able to wait patiently for Him to deliver. The New Testament expresses that same idea with the terms patience, long-suffering, sometimes perseverance and endurance. In the New Testament, that type of patience is what can help us overcome trials. It comes from the fruit of the Spirit, or it is one of the fruits of the Spirit. It comes from the hope of eternal reward and from study of the Scriptures, according to Paul in Romans 15 and verse 4. And such patience receives the eternal reward at the final judgment. Such patience imitates those, according to the Hebrews writer in Hebrews chapter 11, who were faithful in the past. Such patience even obeys God, even if it results in death. You see, it's not patience that has no trial. It's not patience that has no difficulty, but it's the type of patience that even in the face of difficulty can bear up. This type of patience leads us to maturity and to growth. In the New Testament, James wrote, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." You see, when we have the type of patience that the psalmist is encouraging and the type of patience that James wants us to have, we become mature, we grow, we become complete. Patience, especially in the times of difficulty, develops our Christian character. It purifies our faith, and it helps us ultimately attain the eternal reward. But that type of patience isn't easy. That type of patience is the patience you have during difficulty. That's the type of patience you have during trial and during trouble and during suffering. In fact, one of the terms in the New Testament used for this type of patience is the Greek word hupomone, which means to bear up, especially under trial or duress. In other words, to not give up, but to continue, to remain faithful, and to remain strong. Not just when it's easy, but when it's hard and when it's difficult. The Old Testament patriarch Job had this type of patience. James chapter 5 and verse 11, James notes that he had, according to the New King James Version, perseverance. Same word here, hupomone, meaning he had patience. Yet when we look at the book of Job, we know that it doesn't appear that Job had patience. He questioned God. He questioned his suffering. He questioned why these things were happening. Part of the reason I think Job struggled is part of the reason for this psalm. Because this type of patience is almost always connected with difficulty, with suffering, with trial. You see, the Bible reveals to us that we suffer for many different reasons. Sometimes we suffer for being Christians. Sometimes we suffer because we do good. Sometimes, on the other hand, we suffer because we've done evil, and we rightly suffer. Sometimes we suffer just because of the nature of this world. With Adam and Eve, sin and death entered into this world. And as long as the Lord doesn't return first, we will all eventually die. We will all suffer to some degree. Sometimes we suffer because of the Lord's discipline. Sometimes we suffer because of the Lord's testing. Sometimes we suffer, though, because of Satan's schemes. We know that's why Job suffered. We know Job suffered because Satan was behind it. He wanted to test Job. The problem is, as far as the book of Job is concerned, as Job was going through his trial, he didn't know why he suffered. And the same's true for us. Sometimes we just don't know the reason. Why is this happening to me? Why is it happening now? And sometimes we have no answer. Sure, we have reasons given in the Bible why people suffer, but which one is it? Did I do something wrong? Am I doing something right? Why am I suffering? You see, the problem is, even when one of those reasons lies behind the reason for our suffering, often we don't know. Now, sure, if we commit a crime and we're put into prison, we know why we suffer. We know why we're there. But what about the Christian who strives to be faithful, strives to be honest, strives to live according to God's will, and he suffers, and suffers terribly? You see, there's a difficulty with patience. Sometimes we just do not know why we suffer. Perhaps the psalmist was in the same category. Why is this happening? How can we be patient in trial? How can we be patient when it hurts? How can we be patient and wait? How can we rest silently when everything around me seems to be falling down? How can I bear up? How can I rest? I think the psalmist gives us the answer in Psalm 62. According to the psalmist, it lies in the nature of God and in the nature of our relationship with him. You see, we can wait patiently. We can endure patiently. Not because of who I am, but because of who God is and who he is to me. You see, for the psalmist, God was his refuge, his rock, his glory, his salvation. The psalmist knew what God was to him, and he knew his relationship with God. And because of that, he knew what God would do. He knew that God had this mercy for him, and he knew that God had power. You see, the question is, what is our relationship with God? Who is he to us? Can we say, like the psalmist, that God is our defense, that God is our rock and our salvation, our hope and our glory? If we can, then we can wait patiently. It may not be easy. It may be very difficult. But if we have that type of relationship with God, we can wait because, you see, God protects us. God delivers us. God cares for us. God loves us. And God strengthens us. And so when we come to the difficult times in life, we too, like the psalmist, need to say, "Be patient, my soul." When our bodies are failing, when disease ravages us, when we're left alone, the nearest and dearest in life to us is gone, we need to say, "Wait patiently, my soul." When we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we need to say, "Wait patiently." When all the world seems to be rising up against us, we need to wait patiently. When fear overwhelms our mind, we need to wait patiently. Father God, give me patience.